Hello, and welcome to the OMFIF Fed Talk podcast. On this week's episode, we talk about the Fed's rate decision, its outlook for the US economy, and challenges to the policy environment. We talk to John Plender, non-executive director of OMFIF and senior editorial writer at the Financial Times. Last week, the Fed announced that it would keep rates on hold at a 2.25% to 2.5% range. Further, Jay Powell indicated he sees no immediate reason to adjust rates in the future, yet debate around the Fed's policy stance is growing due to mixed message from economic data and indicators. So, John, what are your first reactions to the FOMC's decision?
Well, I think that the Jay Powell has confused the markets a little, but I also think that investors were getting a bit ahead of themselves in the expectations of a rate cut. In effect, what Jay Powell was saying was that he could see neither a reason to raise rates or to reduce rates. And I think that's understandable. He's not taking a preemptive stance. And in today's circumstances, where our understanding of how the economy works, particularly since the big shock of the financial crisis back in 2007-08, it's very hard to run a preemptive monetary policy and to give forward guidance. So investors are complaining about a communications problem, but I think a communications problem is probably inevitable.
Yeah, I think that preemptive environment is difficult to navigate sometimes. So Jay Powell ruled out an immediate rate move in the near future due to what he called solid fundamentals for the US economy. Do you think he's right in this analysis? And should we expect any further rate changes late this year? Also bearing in mind forward guidance, or the cut of forward guidance rather, was issued in January?
I think he's making a perfectly sane and reasonable statement. What's extraordinary in 2019 is just how dramatically people's perceptions have changed since the growth scare back in January. The market substantially recovered, or at least the equity market is substantially recovered. Oddly enough, the Treasury market is recovered too, which is a slightly contradictory signal. But I think that recent data on the economy have been quite encouraging. And I think that it's fair enough to say that this economy is reasonably solid, certainly solid enough to justify not announcing an intention to cut rates, as many investors had hoped.
As you say, in the view of some, the Fed has been struggling with its communications. So in response to the messages it put out about inflation last week, markets have responded with some surprise. So do you feel the Fed was right about inflation as well?
I think that one of the big difficulties about making judgments about inflation at the moment are that there are notable puzzles in the market, particularly in relation to the fact that the labor market appears relatively tight. Employers are complaining about skills shortages, and yet there is a lack of wage inflation. Hard to know entirely what is going on. Some people think that perhaps the underlying trend growth rate of the US economy is a bit higher than the central bank previously thought, in which case there was rather more slack than you might have expected. Other people think that there are structural explanations for this lack of wage growth, including things like the gig economy and so forth. So it's very difficult to feel confident in making judgments about inflation. But I think that at the moment, inflation is clearly running below the Fed's target rate. And the decision that has been taken, and particularly the pivot in Fed policy towards patience since the turn of the year, was the right one. The fact is that these puzzles and the things that we don't know about the way the economy works justify policy of wait and see, which is what the Fed's policy boils down to.
As you say, the debate about inflation is interesting. And I think some people from within the Fed have also called for rates to be cut, I think most notably Jim Bullard. So again, do you think that makes sense? Clearly, from your point of view, the wait-and-see approach is currently right. But how else do you think inflation might be combated if it's not through interest rates?
Well, I think the caveat I would make to what I've just said earlier, and I think you could argue the opposite of Jim Bullard. I mean, one of the unexpected shocks that might hit us, perhaps, is that perhaps the labor market will indeed be perceived to be tight and inflation will turn up, in which case maybe the investor's assumption in the past 2 to 3 months the next move is down might turn out to be wrong. I think the arguments are all very evenly balanced. And as I said earlier, I mean, I think a policy of wait and see is the only way to address these rather difficult conundrums.
Yes, I think we've seen some very mixed messages about the US economy. As you say, employment may be somewhat low compared to other Western countries, but then growth is, of course, very, very strong. So how do you see the wider picture of the US economy? How is it performing within the global picture? Can we see any signs of perhaps how that might change in the future, perhaps looking at the next economic downturn?
Well, as you were implying, I mean, I think the first quarter GDP growth was unexpectedly strong, and I don't know that we should attach immense importance to one quarter's figures. There are some elements in that which look a little bit freakish. Having said that, I mean, I feel that the external environment is now beginning to improve a bit because the Chinese authorities have been moving to crank up the economy again, and that will be very helpful also for Europe, particularly for Germany, which has been badly hit by the weakness of the Chinese economy. So the external environment is beginning to show one or two signs of being helpful. Having said which, we've got this problem with trade. And the fact is that Trump appears to be playing a game of brinkmanship with the Chinese, and we cannot forecast the outcome of these negotiations, but they could be very unhelpful, particularly for equity markets. And we just have to wait and see.
I think, again, the message is wait and see what happens, see as well what will happen in the next elections in the US. Looking at the role of the US dollar more globally, how do you see it as a global reserve currency at the moment, and how this could change again in the future?
Well, it's always been dangerous to predict the demise of the dollar as a preeminent reserve currency in the world. I mean, the fact is that the US Treasury market is the deepest and most liquid of government bond markets in the world, which is the key to running a reserve currency. And I think that when you look at all the other alternative potential reserve currencies, frankly, they're not that attractive. I mean, Europe has fragmented government bond markets. China, there are all sorts of political problems, as well as problems to do with the rigidities in Chinese markets, and so on and so forth. So I think there's no question that the dollar will remain the primary reserve currency in the world. Having said that, it seems it's having to cope with quite a lot of unpredictability in the shape of Trumpian policy. But I think that because it remains far better than the alternatives, it's way premature to start thinking about the dollar's role as a reserve currency as having its days numbered.
Yes, it's interesting to see now how US Treasury yields, at least for the 10-year Treasury yield, is now close, almost at par, actually, with the current interest rates. How you see the bond market in the US develop is relatively attractive compared to other markets, especially in Europe. So how do you see this develop in the current climate and the macroeconomic picture?
Well, I think that if there's a bad outcome to these trade negotiations with China, the likelihood is that Treasury yields will fall further and prices will rise. As I said earlier, I think that a bad outcome on trade would clearly hit equities, and that's not very helpful. I think the other thing, though, that we haven't talked about, when you talk about the Treasury market, it's worth remembering that the Fed is now bent on producing some studies of both the mix of assets in its balance sheet and the duration of those assets. And that could have interesting consequences for the way monetary policy works. But we've been given no clue as to how that will work itself out. But anyway, it's a thing to have at the back of one's mind when thinking about how the techniques of monetary policy might change. Because all we know about the Fed's balance sheet this year is that it's cutting back on securities purchases this month. And it proposes to end all securities purchases in September.
Yes, I think it's an interesting point you raise about the Fed's balance sheets. I mean, what do you think the trend is? It seems like there's a slow sloping off now that some of the assets are coming to maturity date. How do you think the Fed's policy will develop in terms of its balance sheet and normalization?
Well, it's hard to be certain, but the very important change in the way its balance sheet has worked since the financial crisis, apart from just expansion, it's multiplied phenomenally. But the major change is that it's extended the durations of the treasuries that it holds. And I think that if it's bent on normalizing policy, then it must think about perhaps shortening the maturities in its portfolio. But this is pure speculation, and it's hard to say anything with confidence.
If you might turn to fiscal policy as a last topic, considering the US's current expansionary fiscal policy and the ongoing trend towards growing national debts more globally as well, what do you think of the future of government debts? Are we going to have to get used to much bigger national debts as we have in the past?
Well, this is a huge and very problematic question. I mean, the fact is that all the big governments in the developed world have hugely increased their indebtedness since the financial crisis. And that is a potential hostage to fortune, because while it's easy to service that debt while you have these incredibly low or negative interest rates in the world, if we do get back to a more normal economy and a more normal pattern of global savings and investment, it's possible that that will give us a more inflationary world in which it'll be necessary to run much higher rates of interest. Higher rates of interest on these very high levels of government debt would then raise difficult issues of sustainability and possibly of financial stability. It's not difficult to envisage a serious financial crisis on the basis of spiraling interest rates against a background of much enlarged government debt.
Yes, I think that's certainly something to be aware of looking ahead. What, in your view, is going to be the main source of instability in the global economy for the next couple of years or so?
It's very hard to predict. The safe prediction is that there will be financial stability. That is the nature of the capitalist system and the business cycle and the financial cycle. You can point to particular areas of weakness in market. At the moment, for example, loan quality in the American banking system has been going down. The incidence of covenant-like loans is increasing. Interest-only mortgages, they are increasing, and so on and so forth. My feeling is that what makes for a really big financial crisis is a high degree of complacency in the system and on the part of watchdogs. And it seems to me that the watchdogs are producing their financial stability reports. They are monitoring these things much more closely than they were before the 2007-2008 crisis. And I'm not sure whether we shouldn't really be looking more in the emerging market area, and particularly China, as sources of instability. I mean, China has been struggling to deal with the problem of excess leverage. The reason why they've only been able to tentatively expand the economy through fiscal and monetary pump priming is because they are trying to cope with these financial stresses, and they have a huge shadow banking system and real worries about whether there isn't something very, very nasty in there that might give. So there are a number of weak points. And also, if you look at Europe, you've got some particularly weak points in the banking system. The European banks have been much slower to recapitalize themselves and get on top of their non-performing loan problems than in the US. And there are also what the IMF refers to as doom loop risk in Italy, where the banks have very substantial exposures to their own domestic government IOUs. And there is a big sustainability question about Italian debt. And as you probably will have seen today, the European Commission is concerned about the fact that it's almost certain that the Italians will be in breach of their deficit cap on the government's budget in the current year. So a lot of potential areas of instability there. Hard to be more precise about what really could hit us in the near term.
No, I think it would be impossible for anyone to precisely pinpoint what's going to be the cause. But I think you've laid out some very clear areas to look at. As you said, we might be in for another repeat in terms of loan quality loans in the US, different global factors playing a role here as well. But also, as you say, the banking sector in Europe. And in some ways, I think the previous crisis has set us up for the next crisis. I think, to summarize, as you say, the wait-and-see approach, at least in terms of the US economy, it seems to be wise. John, thank you very much for joining us. It's been great to speak to you. To our listeners, if you've enjoyed the program, please do leave us a review, and we look forward to engaging on the next podcast.